Another time, Naz was asked what her ideal scene for 2D, in other words, her dream date, would be. It was eating sushi and going ice skating, but she wondered why that was important. One of her assignments was to study a bulletin of Hubbard's titled The Responsibilities of Leaders. It is Hubbard's deconstruction of the lives of the 19th-century South American military leader Simón Bolívar and his ferociously protective mistress, a socialite named Manuela Sáenz. Bolívar, Hubbard writes, was a military commander without peer in history. Why he would fail and die an exile to be later deified is thus of great interest. What mistakes did he make? Sáenz, his consort, was a brilliant, beautiful, and able woman. She was loyal, devoted, quite comparable to Bolívar, far above the cut of average humanoids. Why, then, did she live a vilified outcast, receive such violent social rejection, and die of poverty and remain unknown to history? What mistakes did she make? Hubbard's analysis was that Bolívar knew how to do only one thing brilliantly, to lead men in battle, and therefore he tended to resort to military solutions when diplomacy or politics would better serve. He was too good at this one thing, Hubbard observes, so he never looked to any other skill, and he never even dreamed there was any other way. Bolívar failed to use his immense authority to reward his friends and punish his enemies. Thus his friends deserted him, and his enemies grew stronger. Craving glory and the love of his people, Bolívar disdained the bloody intrigues that might have kept him in power. He never began to recognize a suppressive, and never considered anyone needed killing except on a battlefield, Hubbard coldly sums up. His addiction to the most unstable drug in history, fame, killed Bolívar. Manuela Sáenz might have saved him. She had qualities that he lacked, but she too made mistakes. For all her cleverness, she never contrived to make Bolívar marry her, which would have given her the standing that she badly needed. She was utterly devoted, completely brilliant, and utterly incapable of bringing off an action of any final kind, Hubbard notes. She violated the power formula in not realizing that she had power. She should have taken on the portfolio of Bolívar's secret police chief, as Mary Sue did for Hubbard. She was not ruthless enough to make up for his lack of ruthlessness, and not provident enough to make up for his lack of providence, Hubbard writes. She was an actress for the theater alone. In Hubbard's view, the moral of Bolívar and Sáenz's tragedy is that those with power must use it. Someone close to power like Manuela has to dedicate herself to enlarging the strength of her partner. Real powers are developed by tight conspiracies of this kind, Hubbard writes. If Manuela had been willing to support Bolívar completely, Hubbard concludes, she would have been a truly historic figure, rather than being unknown even in the archives of her country as the heroine she was. Nazanin Bonyadi was obviously being groomed for leadership. Why else would she be reading about Bolívar and Sáenz? But what lesson was she supposed to draw? She was puzzled by the demands the church was placing on her, which had little to do with human rights. Along with the security checks and the coursework, Naz was told to have her braces taken off and was given very expensive beauty treatments. Will here informed her that the director of the special project had decided that her hair had too much red in it, so a stylist to the stars came to the Celebrity Center to darken and highlight her hair. Then came the shopping spree. Wilhere took Naz to Rodeo Drive and spent $20,000 for her new wardrobe. Finally, Naz and Wilhere flew to New York first class. She guessed that the mission would finally be revealed to her. They stopped at the New York Org, ostensibly on routine business, but there they happened to run into Tom Cruise. Tommy Davis was with him. Although it all seemed like a happy coincidence, Naz was a little flustered. Not only was Cruise the biggest star in the world, he had also just been awarded the highest honor in Scientology. She said to him, "Very well done, sir." Later, she was corrected for saying that, because you don't commend your senior. Cruise was charming. He said that he and Davis were headed over to the Empire State Building and then to Nobu for some sushi. Why didn't they join them? Afterward, they all went skating at Rockefeller Center, which was closed to the public while they were on the rink. It was beginning to seem a little too perfect. She spent that first night with Cruise in the Trump Tower, where he had taken an entire floor for his entourage. Cruise invited Naz to hang out on the set of War of the Worlds, which was shooting in Athens, New York, the next morning. At the end of the day, Davis accompanied her back to the city. In the limo, he handed Naz a non-disclosure agreement. There was no lawyer present, and she wasn't given a copy of what she signed. He informed her that the mission was now off the table. This, the relationship with Cruise, was far more important. Davis warned that if she did anything to upset Cruise, he would personally destroy her. Naz wasn't resistant. She wanted to help the world, and she had faith that Scientology could do that. Cruise was dazzling. Scientology was deeply important to both of them. It was obviously meant to be, so why question it? According to several knowledgeable sources, within a few weeks, Naz moved into Cruise's house. Davis and Jessica Feshbach were constantly tutoring her in how to behave toward the star. One evening, she and Cruise had dinner with several Scientologists, including Tommy Davis and Cruise's niece, Lauren Hagney, who was in the Sea Org and was posted to Gold Base. She had been Katie Haggis's best friend all through their childhood. They were at the Delphian School together. At the dinner, Lauren talked about her friendship with Katie and how she had decided to break off their relationship when Katie said she was a lesbian. Naz was shocked, not just by the comment, but by the fact that everyone agreed with her decision. Footnote. Cruise's attorney says that this conversation never took place. According to Tommy Davis, Katie did not lose her friend because she admitted she was gay. She lost her friend because Katie lied to her about being gay. End footnote. In December, Cruise took Naz to his vacation house in Telluride, where they were joined by David and Shelley Miscavige. While they were at Cruise's retreat, David and Shelley watched a screener of Million Dollar Baby. Afterward, Miscavige said it had been difficult to sit through. He complained about what a poor example of a Scientologist Haggis was and said that he needed to get back on the bridge and stop making such awful, low-tone films. Cruise agreed. "He needs to get his ethics in," he remarked. Naz was having an awful menstrual period, and she wanted to beg off the festive dinner they had planned, but she knew she was obliged to play the hostess. Still, she felt miserable, and her mind was foggy. A couple of times, Miscavige addressed comments to her, and she couldn't quite understand what he said. Miscavige speaks in a rapid-fire Philly brogue, and Naz had to ask him to repeat himself more than once. The next day, both Davis and Cruise dressed her down for disrespecting the church leader, specifically for insulting his TR1. In Scientology lingo, that refers to the basic training routine about communicating with another person. Naz had embarrassed Miscavige because he wasn't able to get his message across. Davis said that her conduct was inexcusable. If she was in pain, she should have taken a Tylenol. With his characteristic intensity, Cruise himself later explained the seriousness of the situation. "You don't get it," It goes like this. He raised his hand over his head. First, there's LRH. He moved his hand down a few inches. Then there is COB. Bringing his hand down to his own eye level, he said, "Then there's me." 2 weeks later, Jessica Feshbach told Naz to pack her things. Cruz was too busy to say goodbye. Naz's last glimpse was of him working out in his home gym. Davis later explained to her that Cruz had simply changed his mind about the relationship, deciding that he needed someone with more power. But the star was willing to make amends by paying for a package that would allow her to attain OT7. Continuing up the bridge would help her deal with her grief and loss, Davis assured her. In February 2005, Naz went to Clearwater to take the courses. At first, she was treated like a VIP, but soon one of her friends noticed dramatic changes in her. She was weeping all the time. Naz confided that she had just gone through a wrenching breakup with Tom Cruise. The shocked friend immediately reported her to ethics. Naz was assigned a condition of treason and ordered to do reparations for the damages she had done to the group by revealing her relationship with Cruise. She was made to dig ditches and scrub public toilets with a toothbrush. Finally, in June, she worked her way back into good standing with the church, but she was ordered to stay away from the Celebrity Center. Davis advised her to go live in some far corner of the world and never utter another word about Tom Cruise. Footnote. Several sources independently told me of Boniadi's experiences with Tom Cruise. All their recollections were consistent. Cruise's attorney says that no Scientology executives set him up with girlfriends and that no female Scientologist that Cruise dated moved into his home. End footnote. The search for a new mate for the star now went beyond Scientologists. Cruz briefly courted the Colombian actress Sofia Vergara, whom he met at a pre-Oscar party hosted by Will and Jada Pinkett Smith. But that relationship dissolved when Vergara refused to become a Scientologist. The religion was a crucial factor, both for Cruz and for the church. Cruz was particularly interested in Jennifer Garner. Other actresses were invited to the Celebrity Center to audition for what they believed was a role in the Mission Impossible series. The names included Kate Bosworth, Jessica Alba, Lindsay Lohan, Scarlett Johansson, and Katie Holmes. Holmes was an ingenue with almond-shaped brown eyes who described herself as a 26-year-old virgin. She had been a top student at an all-girls Catholic high school in Toledo, Ohio, but like Tommy Davis, she had dropped out of Columbia University after a single semester. Soon she was starring on the teenage soap opera Dawson's Creek and had a modest film career in coquettish roles. Church researchers discovered an interview she had given to Seventeen in October 2004. "I think every young girl dreams about her wedding," Holmes told the magazine. "I used to think I was going to marry Tom Cruise." She had developed a crush on the actor when he appeared in Risky Business. At the time, she was 4 years old. Katie and Tom met in April 2005. "I was in love from the moment that I shook his hand for the first time," she later told talk show host Jay Leno. "Cruz is famous for his ardent courtship, flowers, jewelry, and imaginative dates. He took Katie on a nighttime helicopter ride over Los Angeles with takeout sushi." Within a little more than 2 weeks, she had moved into Cruz's Beverly Hills mansion, fired her manager and agent, and replaced them with his representatives, and had begun to be accompanied by Jessica Feshbach, who was explained in press interviews as being her best friend. In May, Cruz appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show. The audience, nearly all women, were in a near-hysterical state of anticipation even before Cruz came out on the stage, so his behavior has to be seen against the backdrop of a highly titillated screaming mass to which he responded like a surfer catching a massive wave. He pumped his fist in the air and knelt on the floor. "Something's happened to you," Winfrey exclaimed. "I'm in love," he explained. "We've never seen you behave like this before." "I know," Cruz said, jumping backward onto her couch. Then he grabbed Winfrey's hands and began wrestling with her. "You're gone," she kept saying. "You're gone." It was a scene of complete delirium. Cruz's spectacular and highly public romance was overshadowing the promotion for War of the Worlds, the movie he had just made with Spielberg, which would be released the following month. A few weeks after the Winfrey show, Cruz did an interview with Today Show host Matt Lauer as Holmes sat nearby. The questions were friendly, and Cruz seemed happy and relaxed until Lauer mentioned that Holmes had agreed to take up Scientology. "At this stage in your life, could you be with someone who doesn't have an interest?" Lauer asked. "You know, Scientology is something that you don't understand," Cruz responded. "It's like you could be a Christian and be a Scientologist, okay?" "So it doesn't replace religion," Lauer offered. "It is a religion because it's dealing with the spirit, you as a spiritual being." Lauer then asked about a comment that Cruz had recently made about actress Brooke Shields, who had written that antidepressants had helped her get through her postpartum depression. "I've never agreed with psychiatry, ever," Cruz said. He was dressed in black, his muscular arms on display. He had a stubble beard, and his hair was draped in bangs across his forehead. He radiated an athletic intensity and a barely contained fury. "As far as the Brooke Shields thing, look, you've got to understand, I really care about Brooke Shields. I think here's a wonderful and talented woman, and I want to see her do well. And I know that psychiatry is a pseudoscience." "But Tom, if she said that this particular thing helped her feel better, whether it was the antidepressants or going to a counselor or a psychiatrist, isn't that enough?" "Matt, you have to understand this," Cruz said, glowering. "Here we are today, where I talk out against drugs and psychiatric abuses of electric shocking people, okay, against their will, of drugging children with them, not knowing the effect of these drugs. Do you know what Adderall is? Do you know Ritalin? Do you know now that Ritalin is a street drug? Do you understand that?" "The difference is..." "No, no, Matt. This wasn't against her will, though. Matt. But this wasn't against her will. Matt, I'm asking you a question. I understand there's abuse of all these things." "No, you see, here's the problem," Cruz said. "You don't know the history of psychiatry. I do." Lauer was taken aback by Cruz's aggressiveness, but he pressed on. "Do you examine the possibility that these things do work for some people? That yes, there are abuses, and yes, maybe they've gone too far in some areas. Maybe there are too many kids on Ritalin, maybe electric shock." "Too many kids on Ritalin," Cruz said, shaking his head. "Matt, aren't there examples where it works?" Matt, you don't even... "You're glib. You don't even know what Ritalin is." He said there were ways that Shields could solve her depression, he mentioned diet and exercise, other than drugs. "And there are ways of doing it without that, so that we don't end up in a brave new world. The thing that I'm saying about Brooke is that there's misinformation, okay? And she doesn't understand the history of psychiatry. She doesn't understand in the same way that you don't understand it, Matt." Scientology's history of psychiatry holds it responsible for many of the ills that have affected humanity. War, racism, ethnic cleansing, terrorism, all in the pursuit of social control and profit. The church has opened an exhibit, Psychiatry, an Industry of Death, on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. It describes the often grisly and benighted practices that have characterized the evolution of the profession, including madhouses, lobotomies, electroshock therapy, and the proliferation of psychiatric drugs to treat spurious diagnoses. Scientology views this history as a long march by psychiatrists to manipulate human behavior and institute world government. Although it's not included in the exhibit, Hubbard's chronology of psychiatry actually begins 5 billion years ago with the development of a particular technique that was developed in the Maw Confederation of the 63rd Galaxy. Take a sheet of glass and put it in front of the pre-clear, clear, very clear glass, which is super-cooled, preferably about a minus 100 centigrade. You got that? Super-cooled, you know? And then put the pre-clear right in front of this super-cooled sheet of glass and suddenly shove his face into the glass. Takes about 20 seconds, then, to accomplish a total brainwash of a case. Now, if you wish to play God, as the whole track psychiatrists did at that time, all you have to say at this time is, of course, go to Earth and be president, or something like that, you know? And a Satan, being properly brainwashed now, will take off, and that's that. Hubbard also blamed psychiatrists allied with the tyrant Xenu for carrying out genocide in the Galactic Confederacy 75 million years ago. There are obvious parallels in this legend with the Nazi regime, which used doctors, including psychiatrists, to carry out the extermination of the mentally ill, along with homosexuals, gypsies, and Jews, and also by the Soviet government, which employed psychiatrists to diagnose political dissidents and lock them away. Hubbard lived through these shameful events, and they no doubt colored his imagination. After Hubbard's death, Miscavige continued the campaign. In 1995, he told the International Association of Scientologists that the Church's goal for the new millennium were to place Scientology at the absolute center of society and to eliminate psychiatry in all its forms. The Citizens Commission on Human Rights, a lobby group created by the Church of Scientology that runs the Psychiatry Museum, maintains that no mental diseases have ever been proven to exist. In this view, psychiatrists have been responsible for the Holocaust, apartheid, and even 9/11. The commission is not above bending the truth to make its point. The president of CCHR, Dave Figueroa, asserts that Osama bin Laden's chief deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, was a psychiatrist who took control of bin Laden's thought patterns. Whatever type of drugs that Zawahiri used to make that change in bin Laden, we don't know, Figueroa explained. We know there was a real change in that guy's attitude. This view is reiterated in the terrorism portion of the museum. In fact, Zawahiri is a general surgeon, not a psychiatrist. Footnote. Also in the exhibit is a photograph of Imad Eddin Barakat Yarkas, known as Abu Dada, who is described as a psychiatrist and the mastermind of the Madrid train bombings in 2004. Yarkas, an Al-Qaeda fundraiser, was a used car salesman who had little or nothing to do with the Madrid bombings. In a list of 218 international known Islamist militants, the only one who ever studied psychology was Ali Mohammed, an Egyptian operative who helped plan the American embassy bombings in 1998. Psychologists are conspicuous by their absence, Stefan Hertog, a lecturer in comparative politics at the London School of Economics, wrote me in a private communication. The pattern is similar for other types of extremist groups. Among 215 leading German Nazis with known higher education, there are only two psychologists compared to 71 lawyers. In another Citizens Commission on Human Rights report titled Chaos and Terror Manufactured by Psychiatry, www.ccchrstl.org/documents/terror.pdf. The supposed mastermind of the Madrid bombings is now said to be Moroccan psychiatrist Abu Hafiza. No such person exists on the list of known Islamist terrorists, nor is anyone by that name attached to the Madrid bombings. End footnote. CCHR's main effort has been an international campaign against the use of psychiatric drugs, especially for children. The Surgeon General of the United States issued a report in 2001 claiming that more than 20% of children ages 9 to 17 had a diagnosable mental or addictive disorder, and that 4 million American children suffered from major mental illness. There is obviously an immense market for medications to treat such disorders. About 10% of Americans over the age of 6 are on antidepressants, and antipsychotic drugs are the top-selling category of drugs in the country. They have become a plague on the school grounds of America, with indiscriminate prescriptions creating a new culture of drug dependency, one that the pharmaceutical industry and the medical profession bear some responsibility for. Haggis has been a substantial supporter of the CCHR. As a boy, he says, he spent most of his days staring out the window daydreaming, a candidate for an attention deficit disorder diagnosis. I identified with the oddballs and the misfits, he said. Those who conform have very little chance of making a difference in life. He was sure that if his parents had medicated him, he might never have become a writer. He hosted fundraisers for CCHR in his home. I simply believe that psychiatric drugs are overprescribed, especially to children, he said. I think that is a crime. Scientologists have been seeking ways of criminalizing psychiatric remedies. In the same period that Cruz was chastising Brooke Shields for taking antidepressants, Kirstie Alley and Kelly Preston were testifying before state lawmakers in Florida who passed a bill written in part by Scientologists that would hold school teachers criminally liable for suggesting to parents that their children might be suffering from a mental health condition, such as attention deficit disorder. Governor Jeb Bush vetoed the bill. Governor John Huntsman did the same in Utah. Similar bills have been pushed by the CCHR in other states. In her Florida testimony, Kirstie Alley held up photographs of children who had committed suicide after taking psychotropic drugs. None of these children were psychotic before they took these drugs, she asserted, sobbing so hard she could barely speak. None of these children were suicidal before they took these drugs. Some drug makers have covered up studies that indicate an increased danger of suicidal or violent thoughts caused by psychotropic medicines. Eli Lilly, for instance, suppressed data showing that patients who were taking the popular drug Prozac, the only antidepressant certified as safe for children, were 12 times more likely to attempt suicide than patients taking similar medications. Antidepressants have been implicated in a number of schoolyard shootings, such as the 1999 Columbine High School massacre, where two students killed 12 of their classmates and a teacher. One of the killers was taking Luvox at the time. Adderall, one of the drugs cited by Cruz, is an amphetamine often prescribed for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It sometimes causes increased aggression in children and adolescents. Ritalin, the most common drug prescribed for ADHD, is similar to cocaine in its potential for addiction. According to the Primary Care Companion to the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, a person using Ritalin, Adderall, or other cocaine-like drugs can experience nervousness, restlessness, agitation, suspiciousness, paranoia, hallucinations and delusions, impaired cognitive functions, delirium, violence, suicide, and homicide. But people who are taking antidepressants, antipsychotics, and mood-stabilizing drugs are already at a higher risk for suicide or violent behavior. One of the dangers of prescribing an antidepressant is that it may give the patient the stimulus he or she needs to act on suicidal impulses that are already present. Sudden withdrawal from antidepressants can prompt suicidal thoughts as well. Several studies have found that the risk of suicide was just as great for those who don't receive antidepressants as for those who do. Over time, however, patients taking antidepressants are less likely to kill themselves. Such medications now come with warnings about increased suicidal behavior. And yet one study noted the steady decline of overall suicide rates in the United States since fluoxetine, Prozac, was introduced in the American market. The authors estimated that the drug was responsible for saving 33,600 lives between 1988 and 2002. There are numerous examples of Scientologists who have considered or actually committed suicide or engaged in violence who might have been helped if they had taken psychotropic medicines. In Buffalo, New York, on March 13, 2003, L. Ron Hubbard's birthday, 28-year-old Jeremy Perkins stabbed his mother 77 times. He was a schizophrenic with a history of violence and hallucinations who had rejected psychiatric treatment because he was a Scientologist. Hannah Eltringham, who had been Hubbard's chief deputy, believes that Scientology itself caused her own shattered mental state. For years after attaining OT3, Eltringham had frequent thoughts of suicide. The unremitting migraines and voices in her head made her despair. Several times, she came close to jumping off the top floor of the church's headquarters in Clearwater, but restrained herself because she was worried that it would bring disgrace upon the church and Hubbard's teachings. It was only when she left the church and began taking Prozac that her headaches and her suicidal thoughts went away. "It has changed my life," she claimed. Her friend, Mary Florence Barnett, Shelley Miscavige's mother, had similar symptoms, constant headaches and suicidal thoughts. She confided to Eltringham that she wanted to kill herself in order to stop the suppressive body thetans from taking over her mind. Barnett eventually went outside the official church to receive Scientology counseling, a heretical practice known in Scientology as squirreling. The church denies that Barnett became involved with dissident Scientologists, but if she had, that would have placed David and Shelley Miscavige in a compromised position with the church. They would have been potential trouble sources if they failed to disconnect from her. On September 8, 1985, Barnett's body was found. She had been shot 3 times in the chest and once through the temple with a rifle. Both of her wrists were slashed. She left 2 suicide notes. The Los Angeles County Medical Examiner ruled her death a suicide. In 2007, Kyle Brennan, 20 years old, who was not a Scientologist, went to stay with his father, a member of the church, in Clearwater. Brennan was taking Lexapro, an antidepressant heavily promoted by its manufacturer, Forest Laboratories. He was also under the care of a psychiatrist. According to court records, Brennan's father, Thomas, was ordered to handle his son. Thomas Brennan's auditor was Denise Miscavige Gentile, David Miscavige's twin sister. She spoke on the phone to Kyle's mother, who was not a Scientologist, and urged her to enroll her son in Narcanon, the church's drug treatment program. His mother refused, pointing out that the program costs approximately $25,000. Moreover, Kyle was not a drug addict. She sued, charging that church officials had ordered Thomas Brennan to lock his son's Lexapro in the trunk of his car. Days after that, Kyle shot himself to death with a .357 Magnum that his father kept in his bedside table. The suit was dismissed for lack of evidence. The long history of humanity's inadequate attempts to deal with depression and the manifold ways in which insanity expresses itself have never yielded a clear path. Tragedies such as the suicide of Kyle Brennan demonstrate the danger of dogmatic interpretations of psychiatry, such as those offered by Tom Cruise and other Scientology celebrities on the subject. The American Psychiatric Association felt so threatened by Cruise's statements on the Today Show that the president of the organization issued a statement affirming that mental illnesses are real medical conditions. It is irresponsible for Mr. Cruise to use his movie publicity tour to promote his own ideological views and deter people with mental illness from getting the care they need, said Stephen S. Sharfstein, the president of the APA. But at the 2005 annual meeting of the International Association of Scientologists, Mike Rinder, who had been let out of the hole for the occasion, credited Cruise with persuading the Food and Drug Administration to post suicide warnings on the labels of two psychiatric drugs within days of his interview with Lauer. "If someone wants to get off drugs, I can help them," Cruise told the German magazine Der Spiegel in April 2005. "I myself have helped hundreds of people get off drugs." Haggis had sent a rough cut of his movie Crash to the Toronto Film Festival, an important venue for independent films that are looking for distribution. In September 2004, the movie met its first audience at the Elgin Theater, an elegant old vaudeville house downtown, not far from the spot where Paul sold tickets at the soft porn theater his professor used to run. As he watched the movie, Haggis was appalled. Everything that was wrong was glaringly apparent on the huge screen. He sat glumly waiting for it to end, calculating what could be salvaged. So when the audience rose to its feet at the end, cheering, Haggis couldn't believe what was happening. Lionsgate Films bought Crash for $3.5 million and scheduled it for release the following spring. Crash opened quietly in April 2005. There were no billboards or bus signs, which were already touting the arrival of War of the Worlds in June. The reviews for Crash were passionate but polarized. Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars, calling it a movie of intense fascination. A.O. Scott, who reviewed it for the New York Times, was less infatuated. "It was a frustrating movie," he wrote, "full of heart and devoid of life, crudely manipulative when it tries hardest to be subtle, and profoundly complacent in spite of its intention to unsettle and disturb." There was no actual premiere, just a screening at the Academy Theater on Wilshire Boulevard, and no grand party afterward. Haggis and his family went out to dinner. Despite the conflicting reviews and limited distribution, a groundswell was building for the movie, driven entirely by audiences who were caught up in a national conversation over race and class that the movie prompted. It would go on to earn nearly $100 million in international sales. Million Dollar Baby had just won the Academy Award for Best Picture that February. Haggis was writing a James Bond movie, Casino Royale, in addition to the Eastwood picture, Flags of Our Fathers. He was flying. Tom Cruise's career was headed in the opposite direction. Haggis had seen him at the Vanity Fair Oscar party. Cruise and Tommy Davis arrived on Ducati motorcycles wearing black jackets and were let in the back door of Morton's Steakhouse in Beverly Hills. They said hello to Haggis, but nothing more. Polls showed that Cruise was still ranked as the most powerful actor in Hollywood and even the most powerful celebrity in the world, but he was also ranked number one as the celebrity that people would least like to have as their best friend. When Cruise returned to Gold Base, Miscavige showed off his Harley-Davidson V-Rod motorcycle, which had been custom-painted a candy apple red over a brushed nickel surface. Miscavige's brother-in-law, John Brousseau, known for his elegant craftsmanship, had done the work. In addition to overseeing the renovation of the Free Winds, Brousseau had installed bars on the doors of the hole shortly after Rathbun escaped. According to Brousseau, Cruz was drooling over the motorcycle. "God, could you paint my bike like that?" he asked. Brousseau looked at Miscavige, who nodded. Cruz brought in two motorcycles to be painted, a Triumph Rocket 3 and a Honda Rune. Spielberg had given him the Honda after the filming of War of the Worlds. It had already been custom painted by the set designer. Brousseau had to take each motorcycle apart completely and nickel plate all the parts before painting them. Footnote. The church denies Brousseau's account. Cruz's attorney denies that his client ever saw Miscavige's motorcycle and claims, "We have photographic evidence showing the actual painter doing the job. It's not Mr. Brousseau." However, the attorney did not provide the photos. Brousseau did provide photos of the work he says he did on each of Cruz's vehicles he claimed to have worked on. End footnote. Cruz drove the newly painted Rune with Katie on the back to the fans' screening of his movie at Grauman's Chinese Theater in June. After that, Brousseau was regularly assigned to work on special projects for Cruz. Shelley Miscavige had drafted Brousseau and seven other Sea Org members, along with many of Cruz's employees at Odin Productions, to work for more than 2 weeks rehabilitating Cruz's leased 9-bedroom mansion on Alpine Drive in Beverly Hills, painting, fixing the roof, doing cabinet work, stretching the carpet, rewiring, pressure washing the tennis court, weeding and planting, repairing the irrigation system, and even reorganizing the clothes in the closets. In the last week, Brousseau says, he had at least 100 contractors under his direction in order to get the house ready for Cruz. Brousseau and a Sea Org executive, Steve Marlowe, also oversaw the renovations on a Bluebird bus, like Hubbard's, that Cruz had purchased. Later, Cruz bought another bus, which he called the Silver Screen. Brousseau spent 3 months commuting to the Marathon Coach Factory in Coburg, Oregon, to oversee the retrofitting of the 40-foot vehicle into an elaborate motorhome. Brousseau estimates that the redesign cost about $1.5 million, but that doesn't include his labor or that of Sea Org members in the Golden Era prop department who manufactured the furniture, countertops, and cabinetry. In 2006, Brousseau also customized a limousine for the star, using the body of a Ford Excursion that he says Cruz acquired using the Scientology fleet discount. Katie was pregnant and wanted a new vehicle with a baby seat. Miscavige had wanted to impress the couple by renovating the Excursion at a local custom shop, but the job was poorly done. Miscavige purchased another Excursion for Cruz to replace the one that had been botched. Meanwhile, Brousseau spent the next 6 months personally rebuilding the original Excursion. He ripped the vehicle down to its frame and installed handmade reclining seats and wood paneling fashioned from a burl of a eucalyptus tree that had been toppled in a storm. He spent about 2,000 hours on the project. The materials were paid for by Cruz's production company, but according to Brousseau, his labor and that of about 10 other Sea Org members was not compensated. "It was a $500,000 beauty all done by me with other folks from Scientology," Brousseau said. Brousseau had even carved a matching Mont Blanc pen out of the burl, its own hidden storage case in the vehicle. When Cruz showed it to Katie, she was dazzled. She turned to Brousseau and asked, "Oh, J.B., did you make that?" "Don't thank me," Brousseau quickly responded. "I'm just the hammer. This," he said, pointing to Miscavige, "is the hand that wields me." Cruz, who became a pilot while filming Top Gun, keeps a hangar at an airport in Burbank for his airplane collection. Sea Org members completely renovated the hangar, installing a luxurious office that had been fabricated at Golden Era Productions. Brousseau says that the furniture, a dry bar, table and chairs, desks, etc., was milled at an RPF base in Los Angeles. Brousseau took dozens of photographs documenting his handiwork on the Star's behalf. No member of the Sea Org has spent more time in Cruz's service than Tommy Davis, who was viewed within the church as the Star's special handler and personal assistant. Although Davis maintains that he provided similar services for other celebrities, his assignment to Cruz was his primary duty between 2000 and 2004. However, he asserted, none of the church staff involved were coerced in any way to assist Mr. Cruz. Church staff, and indeed church members, hold Mr. Cruz in very high regard and are honored to assist him. In June 2006, Shelley Miscavige disappeared. She had spent her whole life conveying orders and gathering intelligence for a powerful, erratic, domineering church leader, first for Hubbard and then for her husband. She and Miscavige were always respectful toward each other in public, if not openly affectionate. As he gained power within the church, she began to see the two of them as reincarnations of Simón Bolívar and Manuela Sáenz, and the lesson she drew from that previous existence was that she needed to be fiercely protective of her mate and to keep him from making the kinds of mistakes that his character was destined to commit. In the eyes of some Sea Org members, Shelley was brittle and imperious, but Rathbun noted that she sometimes objected when Miscavige's physical assaults threatened to get out of hand. No one else did. That spring, Shelley returned from a free winds voyage before her husband did, and in his absence, she decided to arrange the org board herself. There were no settled posts, executives were still churning in the hole, and the management structure was a mess. Taking matters into her own hands, Shelley made a number of appointments. Soon after her husband came back, Shelley's mood visibly changed. Her brother-in-law, John Brousseau, observed that she looked cowed. The bulldog was gone. Shortly before she disappeared, she asked Mike Rinder if Dave still had his wedding ring on. Then she vanished. Although a missing person report has been filed, the Los Angeles Police Department will not comment on her whereabouts. She was escorted to her father's funeral in August 2007. That's the last time she was seen in public. Former Sea Org members say she is being guarded at a church facility in Running Springs, California, near Lake Arrowhead, one of the several repositories for Hubbard's writings. It gets cold there in the winter. Miscavige sent Shelley a sweater and a pair of gloves for Christmas. In November 2007, Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes married in a 15th-century castle outside of Rome. Among the celebrities attending were Jennifer Lopez and Mark Anthony, Will and Jada Pinkett Smith, Jenna Elfman, and even Brooke Shields. Once again, David Miscavige served as the best man. Part 3. The Prison of Belief. Chapter 10. The Investigation. Proposition 8, the California initiative to ban marriage between same-sex couples, appeared on the ballot in 2008. Paul Haggis was deeply involved in fighting the initiative, marching in demonstrations and contributing financially. His advocacy placed a strain on his relationship with Scientology. For several years, he had been concerned about the bigotry he found inside the church, especially when it was directed at his two gay daughters. Katie, in particular, had expressed her discomfort with the way she was treated at the Celebrity Center, where she had been taking some courses. She had decided to go to another Scientology mission where she wouldn't feel so judged. One evening, Paul and Deborah went to a small fundraising dinner at John Travolta and Kelly Preston's house. Deborah and Kelly were on the parents' committee to raise funds for a new Delphi school in Santa Monica. Several other couples were there, all of them operating thetans. One of the guests referred to the waiter as a faggot. It is difficult to imagine such open bigotry in Hollywood, a liberal stronghold, but especially in the home of John Travolta, who has dodged rumors of his sexual orientation since he first became a star. Despite the onslaught of publicity and sexual harassment suits that have been lodged against the star over the years, many Scientologists, including Haggis, believed that Travolta was not gay. Haggis had been impressed by his apparently loving relationship with his wife and children. But it is also common to assume that homosexuality is handled at the OT3 level, where the body thetans that cause such problems can be audited away. The other diners may have been so convinced of Travolta's sexual orientation that they felt free to display their prejudice. In any case, Travolta reprimanded his guest, saying that such remarks were not tolerated in their home. Haggis was flooded with admiration for the firm but graceful way that the star had handled the situation. After the other guests had departed, Haggis and Travolta had a conversation in his small study. They talked about the bigotry they had observed in the church. Haggis confided that Katie had been made to feel unwanted at the Celebrity Center. Travolta said that Hubbard's writings had been misinterpreted, and he later provided some references that Katie could use to defend herself. When Hubbard wrote Dianetics in 1950, he reflected the prevailing social prejudices, including the psychiatric community, which considered homosexuality a mental illness. It was not removed from the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders until 1973. The sexual pervert, by which Hubbard meant the homosexual, is actually quite ill physically, he writes. The following year, he published The Tone Scale in Science of Survival. Near the bottom, at 1.1 on the scale, is the covertly hostile personality. People in this state engage in casual sex, sadism, and homosexual activity. Hubbard describes this as the most dangerous and wicked level. Here is the person who smiles when he inserts a knife blade between your vertebrae. This is the level of the pervert, the hypocrite, the turncoat. This is the level of the subversive. A 1.1 is the most dangerously insane person in society and is likely to cause the most damage. Such people should be taken from the society as rapidly as possible and uniformly institutionalized. Another way of dealing with them, he writes, is to dispose of them quietly and without sorrow. He went on, the sudden and abrupt deletion of all individuals occupying the lower bands of the tone scale from the social order would result in an almost instant rise in the cultural tone and would interrupt the dwindling spiral into which any society may have entered. Hubbard occasionally moderated his stance, although he never entirely repudiated or discarded his prejudice. In 1952, he said, homosexuality is about as serious as sneezes. In 1965, he refers in an executive letter to a squirrel who, he says, was sacked for homosexuality and theft. Another disaffected Scientologist, Hubbard notes in the same letter, is a setup for an arrest as a homosexual. 2 years later, when social attitudes toward gays were slowly changing, he declared, it has never been any part of my plans to regulate or attempt to regulate the private lives of individuals. However, because everything Hubbard wrote is sacrosanct in the church, these early views are indelibly fixed in the minds of many Scientologists. Long after the founder's death, it was still generally believed that auditing would sort out homosexuality. Gays in the church were frequently pressed to buy courses or take additional auditing in order to handle their condition. The ambivalence in the church over the question of sexual orientation is evident in its treatment of Travolta. Over the years, the church has acted to protect his reputation. Marty Rathbun has said there were many allegations that he helped to make go away. He sometimes worked in concert with Travolta's attorneys, attempting to keep stories out of the press. In 2003, a gay artist, Michael Pattinson, sued the church, Travolta, and more than 20 other individuals, claiming that the star had been held up as an example of how Scientology can cure homosexuality. Pattinson said that he spent 25 years in the church and $500,000 trying to change his sexual orientation without success. That case was voluntarily withdrawn following an avalanche of countersuits. Both Pattinson and his attorney say they were driven into bankruptcy. Haggis identified with homosexuals because they were a minority. They were the underdogs. They were also two of his daughters. The backers of Proposition 8 were using scare tactics to drive their campaign, claiming that homosexuals were going to take over the schools and teach people to be gay. Lauren Haggis actually heard people saying that. Then someone pointed her to a website that listed the proposition's backers. The Church of Scientology of San Diego was on the list. "I was just floored," she said. "And so I sent an email to my sisters and my dad saying, what's going on?" Haggis began peppering Tommy Davis with emails demanding that the church support efforts to reverse the marriage ban. "I am going to an anti-Prop 8 rally in a couple of hours," he wrote on November 11, 2008, a week after the initiative passed with 52% of the state's voters. "When can we expect the public statement?" Davis responded with a proposed letter that would go to the San Diego media, saying that the church had been erroneously listed among the supporters of Proposition 8. "Erroneous doesn't cut it," Haggis fired back. "The church may have had the luxury of not taking a position on this issue before, but after taking a position, even erroneously, it can no longer stand neutral." He demanded that the church openly declare itself in favor of gay rights. "Anything less won't do." Davis stopped responding. When Haggis prodded him again, Davis admitted that the correction to the San Diego media was never actually sent. "To be honest, I was dismayed when our emails, which I thought were communications between us, were being CC'd to your daughters," he wrote. Davis was frustrated because, as he explained to Haggis, the church avoids taking political stances. Footnote: 4 years before, the church had actively campaigned against Proposition 63, the Mental Health Services Act, which raised taxes to provide for increased care for the mentally ill. The proposition passed. End footnote. Davis insisted that it wasn't the church in San Diego that adopted a position against Prop 8. It was one guy who somehow got it in his head that it would be a neat idea and put Church of Scientology San Diego on the list, Davis insisted. "When I found out, I had it removed from the list." As far as Davis was concerned, that should have been the end of the matter. Any further actions on the part of the church would only call attention to a mistaken position on an issue that the church wanted to go away. "Paul, I've received no press inquiries," he said. "If I were to make a statement on this, it would actually bring more attention to the subject than if we leave it be." But Haggis refused to let the matter drop. "This is not a PR issue. It is a moral issue," he wrote in February 2009. "Standing neutral is not an option." In the final note of this exchange, Haggis conceded, "You were right. Nothing happened. It didn't flap, at least not very much. But I feel we shamed ourselves." Since Haggis's children had been copied on the correspondence with Davis, it helped clarify Lauren's stance with the church. At first, Davis's responses gave her hope, but then she realized they're just trying to minimize it as much as possible. After that, I was totally done with the church. The experience also helped her to see her father in a different light. It's like night and day from when I first moved in with him, she said. I didn't know that my dad loved me. Because Haggis stopped complaining, Davis felt that the issue had been laid to rest. But far from putting the matter behind him, Haggis began an investigation into the church. His inquiry, much of it conducted online, echoed the actions of the lead character he was writing for Russell Crowe in The Next 3 Days, who goes on the internet to research a way to break his wife out of jail. What is so striking about Haggis's investigation is that few prominent figures attached to the Church of Scientology have actually looked into the charges that have surrounded their institution for many years. The church discourages such examination, telling its members that negative articles are entheta and will only cause spiritual upset. In 1996, the church sent CDs to members to help them build their own websites, which would then link them to the Scientology site. Included in the software was a filter that would block any sites containing material that vilified the church or revealed esoteric doctrines. Key words that triggered the censorship were Xenu, OT3, and the names of prominent Scientology critics. Although Haggis never used such a filter, one already existed in his mind. During his 34 years in the church, he had purposely avoided asking too many questions or reading materials that he knew would disparage his faith. But now, frustrated by his exchange with Davis, he began poking around. He came upon an interview on YouTube with Tommy Davis that had been broadcast by CNN in May 2008. "The worldwide interest in Scientology has never been higher," Davis boasts on the show. "Scientology has grown more in the last 5 years than the last 5 decades combined." The anchor, John Roberts, asks Davis about the church's policy of disconnection, in which followers are urged to separate themselves from friends or family members who might be critical of the organization. "This is a perfect example of how the internet turns things and twists things," Davis responds. "There's no such thing as disconnection as you're characterizing it, and certainly we have to understand, well, what is disconnection?" Roberts tries to interject. "Scientology is a new religion," Davis continues, talking over the host. "The majority of Scientologists in the world, they're first generation, so their family members aren't going to be Scientologists. So certainly someone who is a Scientologist is going to respect their family members' beliefs. Well, what is disconnection?" Roberts asks again. "And we consider family to be a building block of any society, so anything that's characterized as disconnection or this kind of thing, it's just not true. There isn't any such policy." Haggis knew this was a lie. His wife, Deborah, had disconnected from her parents twice. When she was in her 20s and acting in Dallas, her mother and stepfather broke away from the church. They were close friends of Hannah Eltringham, who had stood up for them at their wedding. So when they had doubts about their faith, they went to see her. Eltringham was then counseling people who were considering getting out of Scientology or other new religions. She helped Scientologists confront the contradictions that were implicit in their faith, such as Hubbard speaking of events that had taken place trillions or quadrillions of years in the past, although scientists estimate the age of the universe to be less than 14 billion years, or the fact that it has never been shown that anyone has ever obtained any enhanced OT abilities. Eltringham also talked about the abuses she observed and experienced. Hannah told us how Sea Org members were treated, Mary Benjamin, Deborah's mother, recalled, how they were kept in a basement in Los Angeles and fed rice and beans if they didn't keep their stats up, how in the desert, in terrible heat, they would march in a circle for hours. Like many active members of the church, the Benjamins kept money on account. in their case $2,500, for future courses they intended to take. Deborah's mother insisted on getting the money back. Deborah knew what a big deal that was for the church. She didn't speak to her parents for more than 3 years, automatically assuming that they must have been declared suppressive persons. But when her sister was about to get married, Deborah wrote to the International Justice Chief, the Scientology official in charge of such matters, who said that she was allowed to see her parents as long as they didn't say anything against Scientology. The Benjamins readily agreed. A decade later, however, Deborah went to Clearwater intending to take some upper-level courses and learned that the previous ruling no longer applied. If she wanted to do more training, she would have to confront her parents' mistakes. The church recommended that she take the potential trouble source / suppressive persons course. Many Scientologists have taken the same course. Deborah's friend Kelly Preston had taken it as well. "I was PTS, but I didn't realize it, and so I was told, 'You need to be on PTS/SP,'" Preston later recalled in her interview for Celebrity magazine. She discovered that her life was full of suppressive persons. "Being an artist and having a lot of theta, you really attract those type of people," Preston said. Theta is a Scientology term for life force. "I ended up having to handle or disconnect from quite a few different people." It took Deborah a year to complete the course, but it didn't change her parents' status. She petitioned officials at the Celebrity Center in Los Angeles for help. They put her on another program that took 2 more years to finish. Still, nothing changed. If she failed to handle her parents by persuading them to make amends to the church, she would have to disconnect not only from them, but also from everyone who spoke to them, including her siblings. She realized, it was that, or else I had to give up being a Scientologist. The fact that Paul refused to disconnect from her parents posed yet another conflict. According to the church, Deborah's parents had been part of a class-action lawsuit against Scientology by disaffected members in 1987, which was dismissed the following year. Footnote: Mary Benjamin says they were never parties to the suit. End footnote. The church required them to denounce the anti-Scientology group and offer a token restitution. That meant performing community service and following a rehabilitation course called A to E for penitents seeking to get back into the church's good graces. It includes repaying debts, taking additional courses, and making public declarations of error. Deborah told her parents that if they wanted to remain in contact with her, they had to follow the church's procedures. Her parents, worried that they would also be cut off from their grandson, agreed to perform community service. For 3 months, they delivered food in a Meals on Wheels program in Los Angeles. But the church wasn't satisfied. Deborah was told that if she maintained contact with her parents, she would be labeled a potential trouble source, a designation that would alienate her from the entire Scientology community and render her ineligible for further training. A senior official counseled her to agree to disconnect from her parents and have them formally branded SPs. "Until then, they won't turn around and recognize their responsibilities," he said. "Okay, fine," Deborah responded. "Go ahead and declare them. Maybe it'll get better." The official then granted Deborah permission to begin upper-level coursework in Clearwater. In August 2006, a formal notice on yellow parchment, called a goldenrod, was posted at the Celebrity Center declaring Deborah's parents suppressive persons, explaining that they had withdrawn the money they had placed on deposit for future coursework and that they had associated with squirrels, that is, they received unauthorized Scientology counseling. A month later, Mary Benjamin sent her daughter a letter. "We tried to do what you asked, Deborah. We worked the whole months of July and August on A through E. They gave the church back the $2,500 for the courses that they never intended to take. After all that, she continued, a church adjudicator had told them to hand out 300 copies of L. Ron Hubbard's booklet, The Way to Happiness, to libraries, and to document each exchange with photographs. Her parents had had enough. If this can't be resolved, we will have to say goodbye to you, and James will lose his grandparents, her mother wrote. This is ridiculous. In April 2007, Deborah received a letter from the lawyer who represented her parents, threatening a lawsuit for the right to visit their grandson. Deborah had to hire an attorney. Eventually, the church relented. Deborah was summoned to the Celebrity Center and shown a statement rescinding the decision, although she wasn't allowed to have a copy of it. While he was researching on the internet, Haggis came upon a series of articles that had run in the St. Petersburg Times, now called the Tampa Bay Times, beginning in June 2009, titled The Truth Rundown. The paper has maintained a special focus on Scientology since the church maintains such a commanding presence in Clearwater, which is adjacent to St. Petersburg. Although the paper and the church have frequently been at odds, the only interview that David Miscavige has ever given to a newspaper resulted in a rather flattering profile in the Times in 1998. Since then, Miscavige has not spoken to the press at all. In the series, Haggis learned for the first time that several of the top managers of the church had quietly defected, including Marty Rathbun. For several years, the word in the Scientology community was that Rathbun had died of cancer. Mike Rinder, the chief spokesperson, and Tom DeVocht, the former landlord of all the church properties in Clearwater, were also speaking out about the abuses that were taking place inside the top tier of management, mainly at the hands of the church leader. Amy Scobie, who had overseen the Celebrity Center in Los Angeles, pointed out that the reason no one outside of the executive circles knew of the abuse, even other Scientologists like Haggis, was that people were terrified of Miscavige, and not just physically. Their greatest fear was expulsion. You don't have any money. You don't have job experience. You don't have anything. And he could put you on the streets and ruin you. Tommy Davis had produced 9 senior church executives who told the Times that the abuse had never taken place. Dan Sherman, the church's official Hubbard biographer and Miscavige's speechwriter, recounted a scene in which he observed Miscavige talking to an injured sparrow. It was immensely tender, Sherman told the reporters. Much of the abuse being alleged had taken place at Gold Base. Haggis had visited the place only once in the early 1980s, when its existence was still a closely held secret. That was when he was preparing to direct the Scientology commercial that was ultimately rejected. At first glance, it seemed like a spa, beautiful and restful. But he had been put off by the uniforms, the security, and the militarized feel of the place. At the top of the church, people were whacking folks about like Laurel and Hardy, Haggis said. He was embarrassed to admit that he had never even asked himself where Rathbun and Rinder had gone. He decided to call Rathbun, who was now living on Galveston Bay in South Texas. Although the two men had never met, they were well known to each other. After being one of the most powerful figures in Scientology, Rathbun was scraping together a living by freelancing stories to local newspapers and selling beer at a ballpark. He figured that South Texas was about as far from Los Angeles and Clearwater as he could hope to get. Haggis was floored when he learned that Rathbun had had to escape. He was also surprised to learn that other friends, such as Jim Logan, the man who brought him into the church so long ago on the street corner in Ontario, had also fled or been declared suppressive persons. One of Haggis's closest friends in the church hierarchy, Bill Dendu, told Haggis that he had escaped from Gold Base by driving a car, actually an Alfa Romeo convertible that Haggis had sold him, through the fence. He still had scars on his forehead to show for that. "What kind of organization are we involved in where people just disappear?" Haggis wondered. He also came across a number of anti-Scientology websites, including XScientologyKids.com, which was created by Jenna Miscavige Hill, the leader's niece, who joined the Sea Org when she was 12. For her and many others, formal education had stopped when they entered the organization, leaving them ill-prepared for life outside the church. Jenna says that for much of her early life, she was kept in a camp with other Sea Org children and little adult supervision. They rarely saw their parents. "We ran ourselves completely," she recalled. For several years, Haggis had been working with a charity he established to set up schools in Haiti. These stories reminded him of the child slaves he had encountered in that country. They were 10, 12 years old, signing billion-year contracts. "And their parents go along with this," he said of the Sea Org children. "And they work morning, noon, and night, scrubbing pots, manual labor. That so deeply touched me. My God, it horrified me."